The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 514, for Monday, August 11th, 2014. You know, we're going to do that. We're just going to keep the tape rolling. I said, for Monday, August 11th, 2014. Folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, cool stuff found. We share your questions, we answer your questions, we share your we just come together to talk about our problems, typically our technical problems, and hopefully we learn some stuff along the way. In fact, that is the goal. I hope that we all, me, you, all of us, leave this show today learning at least three new things. I know I'm gonna. I already know I'm gonna, and that's crazy, but I know I'm gonna. So that's how it's gonna work. This episode is sponsored in part by Gazelle at gazelle.com, the place to sell all your Apple, all your old Apple and technology devices. They'll buy your iPhones and your Macs and your iPads and all that stuff, which is good with the new iPhone 6 potentially right around the corner, likely right around the corner. Check them out at gazelle.com. We'll talk about more about that later. Also, Drobo with the coupon code MGG50 that gets you $50 off the new Gen 3 Drobo direct attached unit. You can check them out at drobo.com, and we'll talk more about them later. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Hey, John, how are you?
Dave, I got so much new stuff happening. I don't know where to start.
I need to vent a little bit.
You're forcing all this new stuff on me.
I know.
It's quite traumatic, actually. You guys don't know how this Dave Hamilton guy gets sometimes, but no.
I'm actually really awesome. Stoked about this. We're going to talk about IPv6 in a little bit here. And honestly, John, the part that I'm stoked the most about is that a week ago, you and I both knew exactly the same about IPv6, or at least close enough. We'd had similar experience with IPv6, and that is we had not run it at all. And now I believe at this present moment, we are both running it on our home networks in different ways. So we're going to talk about that. But I love the fact that we're like learning about this in parallel here, which is awesome. It's great. But hopefully not vent a little bit, but I probably will wind up venting. But I have a couple of tales of woe to, my life has been a tale of woe, since the last time we were here. The first thing I did, John, was on Sunday, as soon as the show finished, I think I mentioned this to you, you know, I was running off of that drive and I wasn't sure what was going on and all that. So I brought the machine over to, I was running off the USB drive because I couldn't get the internal drive to boot, right? That was just this week, right? That we did this. Yeah. So I brought this machine over to the house and I figured the drive was in it. In fact, I said it in the show that the drive was in it. It was going bad and I needed to swap it with the one on the USB. And I had a clone. It was all good. So I bring it over to the house. My daughter and I cracked open the machine. She actually did great. She totally got into this process, which was good because it went on a lot longer than we expected. Turns out it wasn't the drive at all. There was something on that OS X installation that caused it not to boot. Because as soon as I put the drive that was running fine on USB inside this Mac, boom, stopped working. Same exact problem. It would get 10% into the boot process and stop. I don't know what that is yet. I'm going to figure it out eventually. This OS X installation was probably 10 years old on this machine. It started out on a PowerPC machine. It had been migrated and upgraded and, you know, all of that stuff up. So it was certainly time, and we'll talk more about the whole concept of fresh installs later in the show, I think, to answer somebody's question. But eventually I just reinstalled the fresh OS and started from scratch on this. So the fact that you're all hearing this is an excellent sign. It means I did at least some of it. You can still hear me, right, John?
So far.
Good. A Thursday, the last four nights, whatever it is, have been crazy. Thursday night, I wound up in the ER with my son who is away at camp. He got stung by a bee. Actually got stung by 8 bees. and he's got a, I mean, it, he's got an allergy. It's relatively mild in the grand scheme of things, but he wound up needing an EpiPen. So that wound him up in the ER. So we saw him Thursday night. So we didn't get a whole lot of sleep then. And then Friday night, John, I had a gig, and but my son's fine, by the way. He's totally in back at camp and totally, you know, back in the system there, which is great. That's where he wanted to be. Friday night, I had a gig. I got home about 1:30 and a.m. And then we had plans to go to New York Saturday night, just the three of us to go see a play. And I got home and, you know, unpacked my stuff and walking over to the house, and I checked my email and I see a note from our server admin saying that our main web server is inaccessible to them. So it was accessible in terms of being able to ping it, and I could even get it to answer on like port 80 or port 22 for HTTP or SSH, but it wouldn't ever say anything. It was clear that it was, in my opinion, and it turned out to be correct. It had run out of RAM. It had spawned too many web server processes is what happened. It was set to allow too many to spawn, and something happened that caused it to spawn lots of them. And so it paged out. It, you know, it was that whole issue like we've seen on our Macs. When you have too many things running, it goes into swap, everything slows down, and it got to the point where it just couldn't respond, and so it went offline. So we had to force reboot the server, which we did. And then when it came back up, it needed to do a file system check. And one of the partitions failed the automatic file system checks. Then they had to do a manual file system check. Of course, this is all local at our hosting company in Virginia. And then it came back up. The file system check succeeded. Everything was good. The guy says to me, awesome. You know, I'm at a login prompt. You should be able to get it. It should be back up and running. I'm like, yep, can't see it. Nothing. No pings. Can't connect. Zilch. Nothing. So via the phone and support chat and all that stuff, we tried to troubleshoot it. But this guy wasn't really... He wasn't an engineer. He was just an overnight support tech. And this is the one night of the week that this week they didn't have an engineer on staff. So at 7:30 in the morning, after not having slept, I slept for a couple hours, and then the engineers got there, John. So when the engineer got there, he started digging in and he's like, yeah, this is weird. And then he finally figured it out. There are two kernels, two operating systems on that machine. And for whatever reason, even though after all was said and done, we checked and the default was the right one, maybe the guy overnight chose the wrong one from the boot menu, but it wasn't loading any networking because it was the wrong OS. So thankfully, he just booted the right OS and then everything's back up and running. But that was a frustrating little process, as you might imagine. But I did get to go to New York. We got it fixed 10 minutes before I had to send the girls out without me. Bullheaded persistence. It's pretty crazy. And then we were in New York. And then Sunday night, last night, got home and the entire plumbing system in the house decided to back up. Did I tell you about that, John?
I read about it.
Yeah.
I had something similar, though, instead of... I had something similar a while ago, but it was roots.
Oh.
You know, when you live in the woods here.
Yeah.
And you have trees that are looking for water. Well, hey, you know... sewage pipe is a great place to
right
find that.
Right. Ours turned out to just be a blockage. I actually opened up the septic at 1 a.m. I turned on all the lights and dug a hole and cracked open the septic to make sure it wasn't like over full or clogged or anything. And it was not. It was clearly clogged further up the line. And so it was the downstairs toilet that, you know, the toilet was flooded, and then it started coming back up in the shower, which is, you know, bad. But I finally reasoned, I'm like, wait a minute, you know, it's probably 2 feet past the shower here, and I'm trying to get water in that way to flush it out. That's not going to work. I sent Lisa up to the top story of the house to flush the toilet. I figured some momentum on that sucker might blast it through, and sure enough, it did. So that cleared it up, and we were good to go. We were asleep by 3 a.m., John. It was perfect.
Well, I'll clear it up temporarily. Somebody's putting something in the system that shouldn't be there is my conclusion. And
I watched
take a while to identify the culprit.
I watched it all come out Because I was watching the septic when Lisa made the big flush from upstairs. So I saw it all come through. It was just, you know, typical paper and stuff. I think part of the issue was the way our house is built, the ground floor, the basement floor was never built to have a bathroom. It was added after the fact. And so I don't think there's enough pressure when you just use that bathroom to keep the system flowing. And we were away, not just overnight Saturday, but also, you know, for that week prior. And we had somebody staying at the house. And when people stay at our house, they stay downstairs. So I think there just wasn't enough.
Well, you got to change happening. The procedure then, and that they yeah. should use the upstairs bathroom.
Exactly. Yeah. No, seriously. That's it. Even just having
you kind of funny, but like
having him shower upstairs or something to just keep that, you know, flow going.
Yeah.
Don't do anything else except shower or
right.
use.
That's right.
Everything else is off
off limits. That's right. But it's interesting. You know, it's the same troubleshooting mindset that is, you know, it's the same. It's what we go through constantly. I mean, even Thursday night with my son, it was, you know, the same thing. His symptoms were elevated. And so it's like, okay, what can we do to get this managed? It's, you know, it's my whole life is just troubleshooting. It's crazy to say that in the last 4 days, the most relaxing time that I had was the 24 hours I spent in Times Square. that's telling, I think.
Yeah. I try to avoid Times Square. I try to get it as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
It's full of people that have the potential to get in my way, and that's
bad. Oh, they're always in your, of course. Yeah. We saw two good shows. We saw Rock of Ages on Saturday night, and then kind of did a last minute thing and saw Pippin yesterday on Sunday afternoon, and both were fantastic. Really liked Rock of Ages. That was a blast. Totally blast. It was really fun.
Yeah. It's a nice place to visit. And when mm-hmm. we say New York City, we of course mean Manhattan.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Though there are those other boroughs that
yeah, but no, New York City and Manhattan are equal. There are no other, right? I mean,
well, no, New York City includes a number of boroughs.
Oh, is that right? Is the Bronx like part of in Brooklyn part of New York City? Is that correct?
That's my understanding. So you got the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island. I don't know if that's a separate.
Huh.
Yeah. But see, you fell into that trap because almost always when people say New York City, they really mean Manhattan.
Manhattan. Yeah. Right. Right. It does. You're right. Yeah. Bronx, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Queens, and Staten Island are part of New York City.
Wow. Yeah. I got that right.
Huh. You did.
Huh. I'm a very
I told you I was going to learn something new. There's one. Ding. Right. There we go. So excellent. Yeah.
And now what about Long Island, though? Is that
not Long Island is
part
just
of it too?
No, that's not part of New York City. I mean, there is Long Island City, which is part of Queens, I believe. I worked in Long Island City for a little while when I worked for Citibank, big Court Square building. But no, Long Island is its own thing, not part of New York City. Part of New York State, of course. But
well, now I'm looking here at the definition on Wikipedia, and it says most of New York City is built on the three islands of Long Island, Manhattan, and Staten Island.
Right, but Long Island goes all the way out to the Hamptons, and that is not part of New York City. Melville, I mean, all those cities across there are not part of Manhattan. But you're right, Queens and Brooklyn even, right, are on Long Island, but Long Island itself is not encapsulated as a borough. Yes. Yes. Fascinating. Thanks for letting me vent, folks. This is, you know, I was thinking as I was coming over here, I knew that this machine was, you know, new and in terms of being rebuilt. And I thought, gosh, you know, after the last couple of days, even if we had all the same problems that we had in show 512, that would be comforting compared to what I've had to deal with the last 4 days. So. Hopefully we just get a smooth deal here. Let's talk about our first sponsor. I want to talk about Gazelle because, these folks, what they do there is they buy your old equipment, from you and it's awesome. They make it so easy to, you go visit gazelle.com. You can do it on your iPhone, your iPad, your Mac. It doesn't matter. They've got great interfaces on all three. And you go in and you tell them what device you have and what size, you know, how big it is and the specs, right? You tell them the specs and the condition, general condition, bad, good, brand new, right? That's pretty much it. And then they say, okay, great. We'll give you, you know, however much money for it. And then if you say yay, that's when they ask you for your name and your address and they send you a box for free. No cost to you. You pay them nothing ever. You put the thing in the box, you send the box back, they pay the shipping. They get it, they evaluate it, they send you your money. It's that simple. Now, it really works. They'll send you via PayPal, or if you want, they can send you an Amazon gift card and you get 5% extra. So it's fantastic. Now, we know that the iPhone 6 is probably coming, right? I mean, it's got to. It stands to reason. Well, the Gazelle folks have decided that it stands to reason, too. And so here's the thing. If you think you're going to turn in your iPhone, even if you're considering turning in your iPhone, you want to visit gazelle.com today, immediately. And here's why. Normally, you only get 30 days when you lock in your you know, when you go them and they give you the price and they send you the box. You've got 30 days to send that box back to them before your offer expires, normally. But if you do it now, they extend it to October 10th. So that's 60 days, I think, from right now. It might even be 61 if my math is right. And I'm not going to trust my math right now because I'm a little frazzled. But so you get till October 10th. So there's no and here's the deal. The price that they will offer you will continue to go down. And if it doesn't, you just cancel it and go with the higher price down the road. But there's no reason not to lock it in right now. And then once you get your new iPhone, whatever that works out to be, you have the option. You don't have to send it in, but you have the option. You're locked in. So I highly recommend that you go lock in. Again, you're not sending them anything yet. You're just going, locking in a price. They send you a box. You sit on it until October 10th or before. And then you either cancel or you send it in, they give you your money. So go do it right now. GAZELLE.com. Check it out. Put your iPhone on there. Even if you're not planning on getting an iPhone 6, just go put it on there and get it locked in. That way you've got options. GAZELLE.com. Through checkout, they will ask you where you heard about them and choose Mac Geek Gab from the dropdown. That lets them know that what we're doing helps you and helps them, and that helps us. So that's a good, it's a win, win, win. Gazelle.com, GAZELLE. All right, John. So, you know, I mentioned all the trials and tribulations that I went through this week. The one thing I didn't mention was what I did on Sunday night. And I did it sitting in, actually laying in bed with my iPad. I enabled IPv6 on my entire home network. I don't recommend doing any major network changes 10 minutes before you're about to go to sleep. But it worked flawlessly for me, which is a good thing.
Why not?
Listen.
Because you could get one thing wrong and ruin everything.
And ruin everything. And then you're not sleeping for 3 hours, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that okay. Pretty much that. Just yeah.
Clarify.
Yeah, no, it's good. So let's back up a second. This started as something that came up in the post-show conversation last week. And really it started a couple of months ago when our friend Alf Watt, he and I were having a conversation on Facebook and he said something that rang true with me. He said, you really should enable IPv6 on your network. Not that you need it, but it's good for the internet. The more people that have it and the faster we all adopt it. And he says, you've got the technical chops to enable it. And really, it doesn't take much to do that. And so it was at his urging that eventually this came around. So I made the pledge in post show last week. It wasn't on the show, but it was just after the show that I would get it done before the end of August. And I'm not one that typically likes to procrastinate, though there are times when I certainly do. But with this, I chose not to and did it right away. So IPv6, John, let's talk about this. We're used to the current implementation of IP, which is IPv4. And that's the way of addressing all the computers on the internet. And those addresses sound like things like 207.58.150.218, right? That's an IPv4 address. That's the kind of address that we're very used to. The issue is they work great, by the way. They're awesome.
Right. Now,
there's just not enough of them.
Right. And just to lay the foundation here. So an IPv4 address is the size of that is what we call 32 bits.
Okay, good.
And to look at the math behind it, it's basically 2 to the 32nd power is the number of unique IPv4 addresses, with some exceptions, but we won't get into that. But just to talk about the space. Now, when you think about that, 2 to the 32, that's like 4 something. It's a really big number. But when they made it, it sounded reasonable that, well, what? Everybody's going to need their own IP address? Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And the thing, I'm almost certain that was the thinking. They're like, how big of a number? Because computer people like to think in binary, and they figured, dude, we're never going to need more than 2 to the 32 addresses. Or maybe they figured somebody would fix it later on. I don't know. But I think at the point in time, they said, well, just computers should have these. So 2 to the 32 should be fine. And it is. What is it again? 4 trillion or four? It's a big number.
It's a lot. But we've used them up. The last IPv4 address has been issued. Now that doesn't mean that everything's going to crater. It just means that we need to solve this problem. And, you know, even in our homes right now, we only get one IPv4 address. Typically, you might be able to get, you can certainly get more, but in a general sense, we all just get one. Typically our router gets that, you know, your time capsule, your airport or your Buffalo or Linksys or whatever it is. And then that shares that one address by creating a dummy network inside your house. And it works fine, but it means a couple of things. It means that your computers don't, they have to, the router has to use something called network address translation, NAT. That's how it shares them. And so if you need, it creates scenarios where you need to do things like port forwarding and all that other stuff that we've talked about. It does not have the convenience of every computer having its own true internet address. And so a couple.
Right. And if it wasn't for NAT, then we would be in big, big trouble because. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. This problem would be this would be. Yeah, it would be over.
Or if the thinking was everybody needs their own unique IP address and NAT was not introduced as a stopgap, if you will.
Yeah.
Then, well, I don't know what would happen. Well, it would have run out of battery.
We would have run out of a lot sooner.
Someone said, oh my gosh, that we're reaching this limit. We got to do this thing called NAT, which basically creates, as you said, this dummy network or a separate network where everybody still has a unique IP address, but it's not taking up the space. But as you said, that space. So everybody that can get an IPv4 address has reserved it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Okay, and you're in your ISP or Google or whoever wants them.
Everybody. Yeah. Yeah. So IPv6 was created. John, you're going to tell me, because I think you did more homework than I did, how many IPv6 addresses there are, right?
Yes. Okay. So, whereas an IPv4 address is 32 bits, an IPv6 address is 128 bits.
I've heard it said that if we gave, if we took every grain of sand on the planet, each grain of sand could then have a billion IPv6 addresses. There's lots of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're basically talking, so you've basically added 96 bits to the address space. So instead of 2 to the 32, which someone said, is about 4 billion or something like that, you're now talking 2 to the 128, which, as Dave suggested, is a number so incredibly massively huge that, though, who knows?
I know, that's the thing, right? It's like saying I'll never fill up my 40 meg hard drive.
It would appear that it would meet the need of lots of different things having their very own unique IP address,
right?
Because it makes things a lot simpler if you don't have to go through this NAT step to be
correct.
Very honest, that adds a lot of complication. It maybe adds some security, but it adds headache, I think, for the most part, because
it does.
There aren't enough addresses. So
So
that's a huge number.
It's now, a
the
huge
way they
number.
Represent it. We'll point people to articles. I'm uncomfortable with the representation just because it is kind of huge.
It's different. There's a lot of colons and there's all sorts of things. But
you're not going to say 8.8.8.8.
No, no, sadly, you're not.
Well, because it's bigger now.
Yeah.
The thing is, now you have potentially 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 elements.
Yeah.
Versus four elements. So in IPv4, you could say four things and get the information across. In IPv6, there is some shorthand, but you're talking at least 8 unique values.
That's right.
Typically, they're represented in hex, and that's the other headache.
Right. They are in hex. Yeah, that's right. Or at least I've only seen them that way. So
now, thank goodness, cool tools. Like you mentioned, we haven't been using IPv6 for a while.
What's that?
Continue.
Yeah, no, but the issue, so this is the solution. If we all start using IPv6, it's great. Each of our devices can get its own IP address. And we'll talk about some of the security stuff in a moment here. We'll get there. But it, just in sort of a general sense, that's a great thing. The issue is we can't just say, hey, tomorrow, everything will start using IPv6, because here's the deal. Not every device on the internet is capable of using IPv6. There's a lot of things, especially your Mac is, your iPhone is, your router might be, and we'll talk about that too. But things like your Sonos boxes, your toaster fridge, all of that stuff that has IP functionality may or may not have IPv6 capability, and the manufacturer may not be adding it. So what we all have to do eventually is run both in what we call dual stack mode. So when I say I enabled IPv6 on my network, I chose that word carefully. I didn't convert my network to IPv6. I have two different IP protocols running on the network. I have IPv4 numbered exactly the way I used to, using NAT and all that stuff. And then I have IPv6. Now, I have Comcast, and in my area, and I think this is true in most areas. It may not be true in all Comcast areas in the US, but I think it's true in most. Comcast now supports native IPv6, specifically for those of you that wind up heading down this path. They support DHCP version 6 with PD, which I think is prefix delegation, if I'm remembering correctly, but it's definitely with PD. So there's a couple of ways of doing IPv6. You can do it strictly native, but the issue with that is you have to manually get information from your ISP. DHCP v6 allows your ISP and your router to communicate with each other and get those addresses. So all I had to do the other night was just go into my router and say, okay, I want to enable IPv6. I needed to research. The first thing I did was I went to Comcast6.net, which is a great website. It'll tell you if your cable modem system, not your modem, but the one step up, if your neighborhood effectively is capable of IPv6, and I was. And then it says, look here and compare your modem to this list of modems to make sure your modem is capable of IPv6, which, by luck of the draw, as it turned out, mine was. And I think all DOCSIS 3 modems are. So once I knew that, then I also knew that my router was IPv6 capable. So I went in, I turned it on, and I chose the right thing for mine to do the DHCP v6. I restarted the router, and then voila, that was it. And it works perfectly. In fact, well, it works as perfectly as you would expect it to, as it would be expected to. Your computers run, the issue is really now on the computers. The Mac does some weird things. Your Mac gets both IPv4 and IPv6 addresses. And we'll talk about multiple IPv6 addresses in a minute, because your computer gets more than one. Sometimes it prioritizes 6. Sometimes it prioritizes 4. It's a little bit wonky, but it definitely works. That's that part of IPv6. I want to talk about the security thing in a little bit, but I want to talk about you and how you set yours up, John, because you're in a different boat.
Well, I'm going to have another thing here I want to add as a fish shake.
Go ahead.
You're saying that one of the problems here, and I agree with you. So at this point right now, I enabled the IPv6. The thing is that the Mac has supported this, I think because of its Unix roots, pretty much forever. But I look back in history, Dave.
Yeah.
The IPv6 RFC came out in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
Notice 1995.
Right.
How long has that been?
Oh, yeah. No, it's it. Yeah.
You would think that by now people, on the other hand, unless, as you said, people ask for it, the support won't be baked in. It's like, why add a feature that people don't want or need?
Right.
But, you know, it's going to get to the point where things are going to get more uncomfortable in the V4 world and somebody has to pull the switch. But now the way I went about it, Dave, is you actually messaged me using IPv4, I presume.
Yes. Yes.
And you said, dude, here's this tutorial on how to set up an IPv6 tunnel on your airport Extreme. Go do it.
Right.
For Monday. I'm like,
And the reason was we talked about it. Your ISP, Optimum Online, does not support native IPv6. So this is something anyone can do. If your ISP supports it, great. You can just do it that way. And that's the best way. But if it doesn't support it, there's a company out there that will let you tunnel over IPv4 to get IPv6 addresses and do this. And then once you set up the tunnel, in theory, it's mostly equal, right? Maybe. You tell me.
I would say it is, because the thing is, how can you tell that? Now, the first thing I'll mention here, so let me go. So right now I'm looking at my airport.
Yep.
And where you define this, Dave, and this is where it gets kind of wonky. You definitely want a tutorial for this.
Sure.
But
we'll put a link in the show notes.
Airport utility, internet. But when you go to internet options, one of the things you're going to see is configure IPv6. It's going to be like, how do you want to do this? And then it has another thing, IPv6 mode, and tunnel is one of them. Now, the one that Dave is using, so if he ran this and he was using an airport as a router, he would have chosen native.
Right.
Which is the equivalent of what you did.
It's the equivalent of what
tunnel.
I did. Yeah.
And then the problem is the tunnel thing.
What company did you get your tunnel from? Just so we can tell folks.
It was in the tutorial. Hold on.
Did you do it from Tunnel Broker?
I think it was I believe they mentioned that site. Let me hold on. It's on this machine.
All right.
So it's how to set up IPv6 tunnel. Yes, this is a nice tutorial. And they direct you to tunnelbroker.net.
Okay. Okay. So that's Hurricane Electric's Tunnel Broker service. You can do it for free. My guess is they probably also have a slightly better service you can pay for, or maybe not. Maybe they're just doing this to encourage people to get on the IPv6 bandwagon. But
right. And so basically, the tutorial says, go to these guys, register for an account, choose where you want your endpoint to appear. So what's going to happen is you're going to create a tunnel, which is like tubes, like a series of tubes, as someone once said in Congress, describing the internet, which is actually pretty accurate when you think about it.
It is, yeah.
And we're running out of tubes right now, but we have a source of more tubes.
Right, that's it. Yeah, exactly.
So without going into detail, I basically typed in all the stuff that was presented to me by Tunnel Broker, by these guys. Put in the airport, restarted it, and the only things they suggested, this is going to lead a little bit. So number one is type in these values in your airport, and then you will have IPv6 or access to it. The only thing they suggest, which I think is a good lead in here, the thing is IPv6 eliminates some of the work that you used to have to do to expose your machine to the internet. IPv6 kind of gets rid of that. So what you absolutely want to make sure you do here, and they suggest this in the tutorial, is when you go to a network option. So you want to go to the network tab in airport. And then click on network options. There's a little checkbox, block incoming IPv6 connections. And Dave will explain, I think, why you want to check that box.
Well, yeah.
All of a sudden now, using IPv6, and I'll hand it to you, but something has changed as far as how the internet version 6 sees you.
Yeah.
Versus IPv4. And here's the baton.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's true, right? With IPv4, your router, essentially, it got one address, but because it was only getting one address and was sharing that, if an incoming connection came into that one address your router got, it had no idea where to send it. Now, sometimes this was a problem. We had to set up specific port forwards, and we still do have to set up port forwards for IPv4 to get to, you know, if you want to expose your disk station or, you know, your max file sharing or something over the internet, you need to specifically do that. But in general, all that stuff would just be hidden just by nature of the fact that you had one address for your entire network. Well, now with IPv6, you don't just have, every computer has its own address. Your router is truly just acting as a router and is passing the traffic along. So unless you tell your router not to, and it's at this point that your router truly becomes a firewall in the classic sense of a firewall. So you need to start thinking, and thankfully vendors like Apple have built this functionality into their routers to turn them into true firewalls with IPv6. And I mean, you don't have a lot of configurability on these rules, but you have enough to set up a wall to protect yourself. Now, what's interesting, John, there's a couple of IPv6 test sites. There's IPv6-test.com. There's also test-IPv6.com. They're different sites. But one of them tests whether or not your Mac or the computer you're running it from can receive a ping from the outside world, which is to say, if somebody says, is that machine online, and the machine should answer. My router, which is it's a Buffalo router running open source DDWRT firmware. The way the IPv6 implementation is built in this particular build of this particular firmware, which is changing every day, it blocks ping requests. Now, that seems like a good idea, but it's actually against the spec. IPv6, the RFC, or the spec for IPv6 says that all computers should respond to pings. It's part of how the address distribution happens. So it may or may not ever really affect me, and hopefully at some point I'll have the ability to turn that on. I could go in and do all sorts of stuff at the terminal in my router and turn it back on, but it's not that important. But it is, it's one of those things. It's like, okay, well, now, this is evolving. The spec is out there, but the implementation of it is constantly evolving as we move forward. And I have no doubt that there already has been an issue. There was one version of airport firmware about a year ago that broke IPv6 tunneling. And then obviously it works again, because John, you're able to do it, so we're going to see this evolve, and that's a good thing. And that's part of why I think Alf and I share his sentiment that it's good for us to implement this stuff. Listen, if IPv6 broke on my network right now, I probably wouldn't even realize it, let alone actually care. But it is a good thing for us all to just keep testing this stuff, because eventually we do need to be here, and we need to use this as the first priority as opposed to the second. A lot of websites support it already. When I connect to Facebook, it's IPv6. When I connect to Google, it's IPv6, and not just Google for, search. I noticed when I was looking at the network traffic from Mail that my IMAP sessions were all going over IPv6, which is cool, in its own geeky way. But along those lines of security, this is where things get interesting. They thought about this as a security issue, right, John? Because having your machine exposed to the internet and having its IP address be something that's always going to be able to reach you does create this security issue, right? You could say, all right, well, I know I can't get in now, but I'm going to keep targeting that computer, and by golly, I'm going to get there. Well, they thought about that. And you'll look on your Mac, and I think you're probably doing this too, John, but I'm curious. If you go in, once you've got an IPv6 connection set up, if you go into your network system preferences and you go to advanced, you should see where it says IPv6, you should make sure that that's set to configure automatically on one of my machines. And I don't know why I had it set to link local only. I think I had set that years ago when I was having some weird issue, but as long as you set it to automatically, it's going to work right. Your machine will get at very least two IPv6 addresses. The first address it will get is sort of your permanent IPv6 address, certainly for that location. It has your MAC address built into it. So
I found it.
Well, yeah, over a tunnel, it might not. That's right, John. Yeah.
Well, no, I even saw on my Mac Mini, I saw discussions about this. So yeah. if you're doing Wi-Fi, it seems to, it may, but it may not.
Okay.
But I've seen cases where it has and has not, depending on the interface.
Okay. All right, good. See, we're learning stuff. That's number two, at least, right? Maybe I lost count. Maybe I'm already at three. So you'll get one address, but that's sort of Let's treat that as your secret address. Your computer's accessible by that address, but only if someone else knows it. Now, here's the problem. When you go load a web page, you have to identify what your IP address is so that the website can send traffic back to you. And if you were to divulge this secret address, it would mean that this address that is mostly permanent for your device is now being spread around on the internet. But because we have so much address space available with IPv6, it's actually built so that your computer generates a temporary address that it uses for connections like this, for all these outbound connections. And these temporary addresses, John, you might know more about this than me. I thought they lasted for, you know, 1 to 3 days was kind of what I understood. Is that, have you heard that? Does that match with what you know?
What I know is that what you said is true. You get two addresses. One is what I would call like a trusted address or, as you said, a secret address. This is for use by people that are on your local network that you trust.
Well, or if you need to set up a static address for people, like if you're a server, like if we were right. our network host doesn't their network doesn't support IPv6 yet. Actually, all the computers and all the hardware does. Their peering arrangements don't have enough peering with IPv6 yet to be comfortable allowing traffic. Right. So Mac Observer doesn't yet have the ability to be contacted by IPv6. But if we did, we would share either that secret address or something that was going to remain permanent, because by golly, we want you to be able to find us.
Yeah. As far as I know, that first address you get is, as you said, linked to the network interface. And I think should never change for that particular machine or network interface. The second one, as you said, is one that kind of rotates. Now, I haven't gotten a clear answer, and I think some of it's configurable.
Okay.
Whether it's, what I got from the few articles I read about it, because I'm like, well, why do you have these two addresses?
Right.
Was that it rotate? I mean, yeah, I guess you can set it kind of like DHCP. Whoever's running the server can set it to rotate however often they want, or maybe the OS dictates.
I think it's the OS. There's no DHCP server being used other than the kind of the negotiation between the router and
I would say and the ISP. Probably makes the most, or a portion of a day probably makes the most sense. So maybe every day, kind of like with DHCP, you may get a new address.
I've seen mine.
And the other thing is, for a security point of view, I think I understand why they do this. So the thing is, I can give you this, temporally based. But has a temporal aspect or a time aspect, and that it's always going to change. So I can give it to you. So say I kind of trust you, Dave. I can be like, okay, connect to my server at this IP address, IPv6 address. And then when you try it later, it won't work
because it's not there. Right.
It's just gone. And it doesn't lead to anything.
I have seen my Macs have three addresses going, which means two temporary addresses, which what I believe is happening there is it has expired one.
Really?
Yeah.
You have two interfaces active. No, I don't.
Here's how it works. You get three, right? One is your secret address. We'll call it that for lack of a better term. And then you assign yourself a temporary address. And then let's say it's a 6-hour window. I don't know that. I'm just throwing that out there. At the end of the 6-hour window, it creates a second temporary address, but it leaves the first temporary address in place for, let's say, 2 more hours in case you had any sockets open, right? Or maybe it leaves them open in a stateful way until it sees that you don't have any more connections open, and then it expires that one. But in the meantime, all new connections go out on this new temporary address, and it rotates out. I think there's a little bit of leapfrogging, a little overlap to keep your network from cratering.
Well, I've only seen two.
Okay.
And you may ask yourself, John, how are you seeing these? And I will tell you. So you told us, of course. Got those in the right order now.
Got that, yeah.
that you saw it in the System Preferences Network. And that's certainly a place to see these. The places that I've seen them, Dave, so way, way back almost at the beginning of the episode here, I was like, well, I've kind of been running IPv6 because the thing is I run both iStat menus and hardware growler,
right?
Which when they display network information, because I had my system, I think similar to you, Dave, I didn't have IPv6 off. I think I had it to link local, which to me sounded harmless enough.
Sure. Sure.
Now I have it set to automatically because now I actually have an IPv6, you know, tunnel running. But before I had it link local because that seemed to be the best value rather than saying off.
Sure.
And what would happen is I would see, I think I only saw one of these IPv6 addresses. I guess it was the locally or temporal one. Because I would see this big hex value and I'm like, oh, well, that must be IPv6. I'll worry about that later.
Sure. Right. Yeah.
Worry about seeing those addresses for a while in both utilities.
Right. Right. So, that's right. Yep. Yeah. It's fun though. I mean, it, from a geek standpoint, it's cool to be on here. And then again, also knowing that we should be testing this stuff and pushing it forward so that
we should.
I think so.
I'm going to tell you how, Dave. You want to know how you can... Now, say you go to the command line, Dave.
Yeah.
Now, you and I are used to commands such as ping and traceroute and all that.
Yeah.
You may be wondering, gee, are there special versions of those for IPv6?
I am wondering.
Well...
Actually, I know the answer.
Wonder no more, my friend. Say you go to the terminal and you type ping 6. Guess what that does?
Yeah.
That's like IPv6 ping.
Yep.
And I think the other one is a trace route 6.
Oh, I never tried that. Really?
There you go. I'm not sure how many much more there are, but at first when I tried it, so I tried running ping from the command line.
That's awesome.
And I ran ping from the command line and it's like, I don't know what this piece of garbage you just pasted in here is. And then I'm like, oh, all right, let me research this. Oh, ping 6. And it's like, no problem. And traceroute 6, and there's probably some IPv6. I got to find a list, but I'm sure there are others where. So if you want to do something from the terminal for TCP/IP, like low level things, try adding a 6 to it.
Right. Ah, that's interesting.
Now it bothers me because I want to find the entire list of these special IPv6 command line tools.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, so, I guess what we need to do is come up with regular expressions always weird me out, but you could do like, you know, from user sbin, you could do an ls on that directory and then only find commands that end in 6 with a grep on a regular expression. So that's an exercise best left for the listener. I think, I don't know. I got to get better with regular expressions, John. If somebody has a way, maybe there's a Lynda course or something I can take to teach me like how to think right about those. That's what I got to check out, man. I'll talk about that during the next, Lynda's not on today, but they're one of our ongoing sponsors. I'll have to check that out. That would be good. Yeah. So do we have anything else to add here? John, with IPv6, I mean, I think the good news is John and I are aware of it. We are at I don't expect ever not to be running it here unless there's something with my router that breaks temporarily, but that's because I'm on native. John, so far being on this tunnel hasn't caused you any grief. If it ever does, I would expect you to temporarily turn it off or whatever. But have you done speed tests on IPv6 to confirm that your tunnel is fast enough and you're not slowing yourself down using it?
I did speedtest.net and I got the same speeds. So I got 18 down, 5 up, which is
that's your service
level with Opt Online. So,
and you got that with 6 and with 4. Is that right?
Well, how do I specifically, I mean, I just went to speedtest.net. I didn't go to speedtest v6. So I don't know if
you go to speedtest.comcast.net, that shows me IPv6 and IPv4. I think. I gotta look that up. It might not. I shouldn't be running speed tests.
Comcast that.
I'll tell you in a minute because it's doing. I shouldn't be doing speed tests while we're recording the show. That would be a bad idea. Okay, hang on. Nope. Brian Monroe put it in the chat room. It's IPv. Oh no, you don't want to use that IPv6-test.com speed test because that. Well, you could, but that one only goes to like France or something, right? Or is that local? I don't know. I can never remember. Yeah, no, speedtest.comcast.net just did it over IPv6 for me too. Yep. It'll do IPv4 worse first, and then it'll do the whole same test over again, and it's doing it over IPv6. But since you're not a Comcast customer, I don't know. Can you access that, John?
I ran the first one.
Just let it keep running. See if it runs again.
All it gave me was I look at the results and it shows IPv6 IPv4 ping, IPv6 ping, but it only shows IPv4 download speeds.
Has it not finished the IPv6?
No, I think it's just...
Because of your tunnel.
Well, I think it's, yeah, you're not with Comcast, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever.
Right.
But
But
it's funny because their test shows me my IPv6 ping, which is...
Right.
Distinct from my IPv4 ping.
All right. Well, we'll keep looking. See, and this is why we're doing this. There is IPv6-speedtest.net. I don't know if that's going to get you what you want. They do have a US. Okay. So, and Brian Monroe is saying this IPv6-test.com/speedtest has a USA server. Well, they have a USA server, but it's in Alaska. So let's be real here.
I was going to say, it's not really United States.
Well, it is. It's not continental. I mean, it's probably got a lot of hops to get there. Obviously, Alaska is United States. I'm aware of that. But, you know.
Alaska, dude?
I'm getting like 30 megabits on IPv4 and to that test. And I've got 100 here. So, anyway. So that's fun, right? IPv6, I think we're good on this. Other than we're here for your questions. We may not, like anything, we may not know the answer.
It will lead to a bright future of all of your devices having their own IP address, and you can talk to each and every one of them, and they will talk back to you. And this is
It is a good thing. Yeah. It's what we all wanted. We've sort of become very accustomed to this whole NAT world that we live in. I remember when I first got a NAT device, it was a 3COM ISDN LAN modem. And obviously it was for ISDN, but man, when I realized what it would do, that it would get one IP address and share it amongst all my computers, I was like, oh, it's magic. And they're like, yeah, it's kind of like magic because it just works. You didn't have to set up a proxy server. You didn't have to do any of this other stuff that we used to previously have to do. So we've gotten very accustomed to it, and it works very, very well. For the most part, most people don't even realize it's happening. But we do need to, we're even if we were to say NAT's good enough, we're still going to run out of IPv4 addresses. So we gotta keep on trucking here.
To me, it leads to the
keep on rolling,
Dave, the bigger discussion is, all right, so you got this Internet of Things that everybody's talking about. You talk to your devices, they talk to you, you know, you, do you really want that? Do you really want to talk to your devices all the time? Do you want them talking back to you? Huh?
Sure. I like my devices talking back to me. You know, there's a lot of good things that go on. One good thing is our second sponsor, which is Drobo at Drobo.com. They have been making some of the coolest devices. You know, these folks really figured out, especially early on, they figured out how to take this concept of, I want to hook a box up to my computer that has a lot of drives in it, but I don't want to have to think about how those drives are managed. I just want to pump drives into a box and have gobs of storage connected to my Mac. That's a pretty noble quest right there to solve that problem for people. And that's exactly what the folks at Drobo have done. And now they're on their third generation of box that you pump drives into and connect to your Mac and then don't have to think about. And they call that the Gen 3 Drobo. And the cool thing about the Gen 3 Drobo is it's USB, right? And so it's USB 3, but it'll work on USB 2 if you want. And, you know, maybe if you just have a USB 2 Mac, the speed's not that slow, right? I mean, you can move data. If you need to move lots of data very fast, then USB 3 is even better. But it'll work over USB 2. This thing's got a dual core processor inside it. That helps it manage, because it's doing a lot of magic to stripe all this data across all these drives, and it gives you fault tolerance. So it's got four bays in it, the Gen 3 Drobo does, and you can lose any one of those disks and not lose any data. So, and if you lose a disk, a big red light pops up. You just pop the disk out. You don't even have to turn the unit off. In fact, you're not supposed to. You leave it on. You pull the bad disk out. You put a new disk in. And then it sees the new disk and immediately starts doing all the work to get your data back. And but even during that time, you can still read and write to the thing and get at all your data. It's that kind of magic. And it's really, really cool. So if you need anything like this, it's super easy to use. And now they've built their software to allow you to create and partition off a Time Machine volume. Time Machine's one of those things that'll just eat up all your storage that you let it see. So if you have this Drobo device that's got, you know, basically unlimited storage, well, Time Machine will find that limit because it'll fill everything up, because that's how Time Machine is. They've built their software to allow you to cordon off an area for Time Machine so that Time Machine hits the wall that you set without filling up the rest of your drive. And then Time Machine will keep kind of, you know, pruning itself out. And that's all built into the Drobo software that comes with this thing. This unit's only $349, which for everything that it does is great, but we don't like great. We like freaking great. And freaking great means you get it for $299 by getting $50 off with a Mac Geek Gab coupon. It's called MGG50 to get $50 off. So it goes from great at $349 to freaking great at $299. And that's just for you here on Mac Geek Gab. So go check this out. These things are super easy to use. It's awesome. So check it out. MGG50 is the coupon. Gets you $50 off, $299. That gets you the same price that owners of previous Drobos could get, which you can get. Obviously, if you have a previous Drobo, you can get your $50 off that way too. But let them know Mac Geek Gab sent you, because that's freaking great too. So check it all out at drobo.com. And John, with that, I want to go through some of our questions. We talked about IPv6 for a while, but I want to jump around a little bit. Where do I want to start with this?
More, you know what? Network grief, Dave?
No, I don't want to do more network grief. We can talk about more network grief next time. But to prep you all, we've been getting all of your questions about AT&T and U-verse and marrying that with your time capsule. So we will talk about that on a future show. But I want to get through some of this other stuff here too, John. So let's go to Michael briefly. Actually, you know what? Let's go to David first. Let's go to David, and then we'll do Michael. Because I sort of already opened this can of worms with David. So David writes, he says, I have an old MacBook Pro early 2008, which I'm still using with Mavericks. I've upgraded the system each time from Tiger just by doing a regular install of the OS instead of a clean install each time. The machine has handled this admirably, but I've noticed that RAM usage of the computer is way up. It went with it from time to time, dropping under 10 megs of free RAM, which I correct by running Memory Cleaner. This immediately restores a gig or more, but it, of course, fills back up if I use a RAM-hungry program. The machine does run both programs. It runs Photoshop and Final Cut Pro rather well, but I do have a GeForce 8600 video card with 512 megs of VRAM. But here's my question. I've learned that this machine can upgrade to Yosemite, so I signed up for the public beta and I installed it on an external hard drive. I booted the machine with the drive, and the computer is noticeably faster in OS 10.10.10. Now, it is a clean install, and there's no software installed into the system other than what comes with it, Mail and Safari and all that. But this has made me wonder if there's a lot of old sludge processes running in my Mavericks install that, if cleaned out, would make the system run better, especially in terms of RAM usage. I was wondering if there's a way I could identify old processes that I don't need to run and get rid of them in preparation for upgrading to Yosemite. So that's where his question comes in. Would you upgrade to Yosemite on this machine, and how would you do it? So, John, I know you're ready to go, but I'm just going to give my quick overview, since I kind of gave it at the beginning of the show, and then I'm curious to hear your opinions about all of this. As I mentioned, I just went through this, and now I was forced down this path. I had a iMac that was cracked open, and we'd put drives in and out of it, and we were getting really frustrated. And so at the 5-hour mark, we decided we're going to cut bait here, and we're just going to format the drive and start from scratch and see if that causes this machine to boot okay. And of course it did, right? That was the issues. I couldn't get this machine to boot with a drive inside it. Once I put a fresh install of Mavericks on it, it booted every time, no problem. And so that's what made me decide, okay, there's some sludge that's getting inherited no matter how I do this with Migration Assistance. So I just got to do it manually. And that's what I did. So far, this machine's been running great. And, you know, the process of doing a clean install, I have avoided it on this machine since before we began the first of these podcasts, John. So it's too long. I mean, that's unreasonably too long, especially for a geek like me, but really for any of us. And the process hasn't been all that painful. I mean, I kind of forgot about it. Yeah, when I started up today, I had recorded a podcast with Adam Christensen the other day from this machine, so that was a good little dry run for me. But in general, it worked. There was a couple things. It was like, oh yeah, I got to tweak this setting, or oh yeah, I don't have Text Expander installed, you know, which immediately I remedied. But you know, things like that. But otherwise, it's been fine. I copied all my documents over. I copied a lot of stuff from my library application support folder, so that when I launched like our chat room program, I use a program called Colloquy to connect to our chat room. Hi, everybody at MacGeekGab.com/stream. It's been helping out today. Thank you very much. It inherited all my settings. All of that was there, but none of the OS sludge came over, and I made sure of that because I didn't copy it over. So it's really not that bad. It took, you know, far less time than I thought. So my feeling is, yeah, if your gut is saying maybe I should, or if you're asking us, should I do a clean install? It's been a little while. The answer is yes, absolutely. That's my feeling. But John, now I pass the baton to you.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Dave.
Do you really?
Ha ha. No, of course not. No. Well, no, my reflection on this topic is as follows. If the software and the operating system was perfect, then upgrading from an older version to a newer version should have no problem, no impact. You know, it goes smoothly. The old programs that are considered cruft, and you know, I want to challenge a lot of people when they reference this mysterious thing called cruft. All right. You know, OS cruft. What are you talking about exactly? In my mind, you can be talking about two different things. One
is that your way of saying, what are you driving at? Is that what you're saying there?
I think so.
Okay.
I don't know where you got that from, but
I don't know.
No, I want to analyze this problem, because when I hear people say, yeah, do a fresh install to eliminate cruft, what cruft are you eliminating versus just doing an upgrade install? And to continue, before your exclamation there, to me, there are two things. So one, it could be old caches, old things like that, things that are left over from before, which may not be optimized or compatible with the OS. Okay. Another could be old processes, which for whatever reason, whether they be system processes or programs that you used before, have left garbage on your machine, and it runs things that are unnecessary or perhaps incompatible. And I think you found that, Dave, right? Which I
Dude,
think was
I,
part
I
of
know
the
what my issue
found
is.
Right. Well, no, I found in one case, I think you mentioned, is that you found an old crusty version of some audio driver or something like that. I'm sure that happened in one case. So the cleanup. No,
I bet my issue was that fan driver. Remember, I had to put a fan driver on this machine because I didn't stick the fan to it right.
Right.
I've been trying to think for a while. And of course, now that I've stopped trying to think about it and you start talking, it immediately comes to mind that that's what it was, because with the sensor stuck, I do not run that fan driver anymore. I don't need it. So right. Anyway, yeah, so sorry to interrupt.
So cruft. No, that's great. So we can classify cruft into three categories then. So one is old caches and old data that's useless. And that, you know, for the most part, it takes up space. Number two, processes. But then number three, third party things that solved a temporary problem, but then yep. kind of got in the way because they were brought over and either you didn't know there was a problem. So no, I'm just trying to qualify.
No, that's it.
I want people to think very carefully. First, when you blame cruft, what are you exactly blaming? And it could be, I think, one of the three things that I just classified in my head here, though there could certainly be more.
I like MLV in the chat room.
The potential for things that are old or don't work quite right to creep into your next version of the OS, I would say, no matter what operating system you're using, will always be there, because software is chaos and it's unpredictable and there are too many options and who knows. And well, you know, we've been doing this for a long time here.
Right.
We try to identify these when we can, or sometimes it saddens me, Dave. The solution is start from scratch or cycle power and things will be better. But I agree with you. And actually, I probably should do this on my Mac Mini. I think both of my systems are updated systems. And my MacBook Pro, I did do a fresh install because it got so corrupted and polluted that It was just inoperable. My Mac Mini is still going from a couple of OSs back on upgrade. It seems to be working good.
But okay, yeah, no. So this is this, you're right. There's and it's the last type of cruft, the type that you know, those old drivers or extensions that you needed and then didn't need and forgot about. Now, I should have thought about this one because this is the most recent one I put on here. And maybe that wasn't it. Maybe it was something else. I have no idea. I mean, I watched this machine through verbose boots and everything. I couldn't figure it out. But I was also in, like, you know, frustration mode, like, because I thought I knew the answer to the problem and then realized, I've proven myself wrong yet again. So, No, it's and that's the kind of cruft that's good to get out of there. The other kind of cruft that drives me crazy but isn't going to ever really cause any significant problems is when I look in my preferences, my home library preferences folder, there's just gobs and gobs of stuff out there for apps I don't use anymore. You know, I launch an app once, it builds it, you know, and
it's one of my topics.
Yeah,
it's annoying. It takes up an infinitesimal. I mean, you know, how much do they take up each? But it's
why I don't worry about
it's
it.
It's like, right. I don't need
it. But it's a pain in the neck when I'm trying to look for something. It's like, oh, yeah, there's a jillion things I'm never going to use, but whatever. Yeah. So
I've noticed every once in a blue moon, something parks a whole boatload of data in application support, usually.
Yeah.
Which is where good apps should put their extras that, you know, you may want to clean up later. But I've noticed that on occasion. They'll put a big map file or audio or video or something there. And it's like, oh, whoa, man.
Yeah. All right. Where are we on? Okay. So we should do some quick ones. I'm going to skip Michael, John. We're going to do that next week because I want to dive deep in into that one a little bit for you. Yeah. All right. So you know what? Share Ralph's thing. That's a good quick one. And it's a good reminder for all of us.
All right. Ralph has a mystery. Here's the mystery. He has a 2012 MacBook Pro. That's not very mysterious. Unless it's mysterious.
No.
OS 10.9.4, Netgear, router, HP J4580 printer. What is that? I looked it up. It is a multifunction unit that has a USB port, and I think that's pretty much how you talk to this thing. So the question was, prior to upgrading Mavericks, my HP OfficeJet printer worked flawlessly, plugged into the USB port on my router, allowing me to print wirelessly. When 10.9 came along, the printer stopped responding to print jobs. Mavericks can find the printer, which comes up as nearby printer in the add printer dialog. The driver signs and the printer is added. The print job goes through. No error messages, but nothing ever prints.
What's the problem? It's a paperless world, man. The printer's just trying to get on board with it.
Yeah, well, I sell printers then.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Man. Never mind. Sorry.
The only thing I could come to, so... And actually, I thought of an additional one, but the initial one that I would do, and this is kind of a Hail Mary thing, but the thing is, when your printing subsystem is screwed up, which it sounds like I would conclude that this is the case here, you want to go to System Preferences under the Hardware category, Print and Scan. And when you're in the section that shows your printers, you know what you do? You right-click there, and it says Reset Printing System. Now, warning, that will nuke all of the printers in the printer area. Sometimes this is necessary to clean out. Well, we were just talking about cruft. There could be some cruft in your printing system that the OS upgrade didn't deal with properly. So
that's right. I probably don't have a printer defined on this computer.
So you can delete the individual units, but it sounds to me like, you know, as long as you don't have like tons of printers in there, I would say again, reset printing system, warning, danger. It will eliminate
all
of the devices.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It is good though. I wish it was more obvious. I mean, it's right there. It's not hard to get to, but I liked it when you came up with this one for this week's show because it's a good reminder that's a good thing to do.
And we'll see if that does it.
But, yeah, hopefully.
That would be my suggestion. The other is, I've noticed this on occasion, and I don't know how things get in this state. Sometimes you may have a print queue that's paused.
It usually warns you, usually, when you try to print that the queue is paused. Usually.
I think it depends on the driver, but I've seen this happen, or I had a situation one time, it wasn't very recently, where, the problem was I looked at my print queue, and how do you find your print queue? Well, the thing is typically what will happen is if you take the name of the printer, like one of my printers is named Dingo.
I like it.
As in Zoot.
I was going to say, is one Zoot?
I do not have, Zoot is no longer on the network. Zoot was my... Mac 2CI, which was my first. But I still have Dingo. They were once a pair.
That's awesome.
And everybody watch Monty Python and the Holy Grail if you don't know what we're talking about. Zoot and Dingo really play an important part in the whole movie.
Speaking of which, John, you know, Rock of Ages, the two things I saw in New York were not the only theater that I saw last week. On Wednesday night, before all the excrement hit the oscillating air movement device for me, I saw Spamalot, a local production, a summer stock kind of production of Spamalot. Spamalot is the Monty Python
like Spam.
Well, it was the Monty Python and the Holy Grail story. It turned into a play, and they've added songs and stuff to it that didn't exist in the movie. But it's all your favorite lines from the movie, and it's so well done. This local production, I mean, the script is well done. Obviously, each production you see is going to vary on who puts it together in terms of the quality. But the script was great, the score was great, and the production we saw here at the Hackmatack Theater in Maine was just awesome. So just a little thing out there. If you're a Monty, John, you especially should definitely go see it. Yep.
So what you can do. So one, I'm going to answer MLV in our chat room, because it's like MLV, Zoot and Dingo were in the Castle Anthrax. And no, that's not a very good name for a castle.
No, it's not.
So what you do if you want to bring up the status of a printer is you take the name of it. So what I did is in Spotlight, I would type in Dingo and it says top hit. Oh, well, that's your printer named Dingo. And then it will bring up the print queue for that printer and it will show you the status, including whether there are paused jobs in there or not. Because if they are, then you'll see them listed and you can unpause them. And again, I've seen that happen where everybody's like, dude, nothing's printing. Why not? Well, either you or some application paused your print queue and that's why. Everything's just backing up there.
That's it. It's backed up. You need to flush it out. Sorry.
Like you did with your pipes, yo.
Yeah. I'm still kind of coming down from all this crazy stuff I had to deal with. So I apologize for the outbursts here. John, you want to take Ray's question and just turn it into a quick tip of how to share videos? Because PhotoStream, as it turns out, does not automatically share videos, even when you create a shared photo stream.
I don't have it in front of me, but I think I could do it from memory here. So Ray had a problem where he was trying to access a video that he shared with iCloud. Now, he said he was sharing it with PhotoStream, but I don't think that was entirely accurate, because when he wrote me, I said, well, the way you can get this is, go to PhotoStream, select the video, and then at least in PhotoStream, the normal PhotoStream, when you select a photo, you will see the share icon, or what I call the share icon, which is the box with the up pointing arrow. And that typically gives in iOS apps. And I don't know if they use that icon on the Mac. I think it's mostly iOS, but it's the share icon. No, I think they may use it on some OS X apps, but that lets you share. And I said, well, dude, just take the video and share it and send it to yourself. And there you get it. Because he said the problem was I was getting an error message saying cannot play video. And I'm like, well, that stinks. And I guess he deleted the original, so it was only in the stream. But then he wrote back to me saying, well, I'm not seeing this share icon when I select it. And I'm like, oh, that's because it's a video. And the thing is, Dave, I assumed that PhotoStream would let you share videos and pictures.
Yeah.
But probably like you, I don't do a lot of videos on the phone.
I do a ton on my phone.
Now, the thing is,
but I don't share them.
Ray brought this up and said, what are you, nuts? You know, I'm not seeing this icon. I'm like, whoops, I goofed. So I went back, I made a video on my iPhone, and then I'm like, well, why is it not in my photo stream? That's because that's not how it works. You can share a video via what they call photo stream. And so the problem is it's kind of misleading. So you got to specifically choose to share a video using iCloud streaming is what I'm going to call it.
Okay.
Now what happens is once you share the stream, you can send invites to people and they'll get an invite, or you can actually go into, so once you take the video and you share it, you can then, I think on a further preference screen from that, you can actually say, share this publicly and it'll give you a URL. This will also happen if you invite someone to check out that video. And where am I going with this? You may be. And I'm like, well, I'm going to tell you where I'm going with this is once you somehow, you either get the public URL by saying share publicly, or you invite someone to see that video. If they go with a web browser to see that video, one of the options on the iCloud on the page will be download. So okay. If for some reason you've deleted it from your original device, but it's still in a shared stream, this is the only way that I could figure out how to retrieve it and save it on your Mac.
So it's up there. It's just not automatically going to come down. That's weird.
I think the thing is that the once you've deleted the original, getting the original back, I just described the hoop you got to jump through. You got to take a side hoop there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Now, to me, the solution here would be, do we really want a photo stream to be sharing videos? And I would argue probably not.
Oh, I do. I definitely think so.
Really?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
It should be an option. But as far as I could tell, this is currently not a capability of photo stream.
Right.
The generic photo stream. You can share a video using, again, what I'll call iCloud streaming.
Right.
But it's not in your main photo stream. Now, maybe that. Yeah, I think they should refine it a little bit because, yeah, if they're short. The thing is, I could see that getting quickly unmanageable and that you take up all your space and blow everything out.
Yeah, but you're not taking. Well, that's the thing, right? Photo stream is limited to 1,000. It's not limited to space. It's number. So, yes, I mean, I get it. But still, it's like, dude, people take videos with their freaking iPhones. You know, speaking of videos with iPhones, I asked on a recent show, John, about how to manage all those videos that we take with our iPhones. And there's really no great answer. Or at least I didn't have one. Giles wrote in and he says, you were bemoaning the lack of options for managing all those home video clips that pile up on our iDevices. And I was surprised you didn't mention Vimeo. Sharing to the service is baked into iOS. And let's face it, our iPhones are where we generate all these clips, which is true. It's easy to share once the video's there and just as easy to make them completely invisible as a default so that you're not automatically just sharing with anybody that looks you up on Vimeo. And there are good iPhone and iPad apps for Vimeo specifically. One particular feature I like, and this is a trend that I see coming up a lot, and I got to dig more into this program, but he says one particular feature I like is that the journaling app Day One will embed Vimeo videos directly into a journal entry when you paste the link. It's these little family vignettes that are so suited to a journal entry, and they work really nicely together. The Vimeo app is free, although if you upgrade to Vimeo Plus, you get unlimited uploads and more than enough storage. Worth considering? I think so. Yeah, I like that. And I got to get into Day One. I feel like this is a great part, you know, especially with that. How am I supposed to gift titty? I don't know how I'm supposed to say it. It's that Day One, if this, then that thing that pulls from all your social services and automatically creates your things. A podcast listener, a Mac Geek Gab listener wrote it. And every time I say the name, it sounds dirty, but it's not. And so it's awesome. So that's, I gotta do this because it would be great to have journal entries every day from everything that I post to Facebook and all that stuff. Like if you wanted to see the selfie I posted of myself in that weird robe and now cymbals are crashing down around me and it's like a Who concert in here. What's going on? Mm-hmm. Okay. Speaking of the Who, you know, next episode is 5:15. I just figured I'd throw that out there. Yeah.
What's 5:15 mean?
It's a Who song.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. All right. I got a couple more quick tips, John, that I'm going to try and blaze through here. David says, listening to episode 513, where you were speaking of radar detectors and wanted an app that in the app could warn you about when you were X miles an hour over the speed limit. Navigon GPS app offers speed warnings, which can be set for 5, 10 or 15 over the limit or turned off. So there you go. I'd totally forgotten about that. Beautiful thing. I wish I had read David's email before we headed down to New York because we took Lisa's car, which didn't have that escort thing in it. So that's that. Thank you, David. Good stuff. Two more, John. I think I can get there. I think we can make this one happen. Brett writes, with Yosemite coming out in the next few months and having learned that you'll need Bluetooth 4 to deal with all the cool new handoff features. I did not know that, but that turns out to be the case. Here's a tip found after much frustrating search for how to get Bluetooth 4 working on Mavericks without buying a new Mac. The link explains it all. And he's right. You can buy a little dongle, a little Bluetooth 4 dongle for your Mac, and you can get them for like $15 or less. We'll put a link to this article that talks about it. But the issue is it doesn't use it will still continue to use built-in Bluetooth by default. You have to issue a, you have to do a little command. I don't think it's a terminal command. I think you go into the Bluetooth setup. No, it is a terminal command, right? I think. No, you run the Bluetooth Explorer app from DevTools, and you can set what it should, what your Mac should use as the default Bluetooth host controller. And you set it to this new little dongle that has Bluetooth 4 LE and you're good to go. So that's that. Did I put that in the show notes yet? I think I did. I think, or I put it in the chat room and hopefully somebody beat me to it. No, I think somebody's going to beat me to it. All right, great. That's that. Lastly, John, or at least lastly for me, I don't know if you have anything lastly, but the last thing I want to share is something that Adam Christensen hit me to. It's called Shodan, S-H-O-D-A-N-H-Q.com. You know, it's interesting. We were talking about IPv6, where there's all these devices that are online, and we've got to be careful of all of that stuff. And then earlier this week, there was that, or last week, there was that Synology CryptoLocker hack, where people could target old disk stations that, or disk stations that had old software on them, and lock up their files and hold them for ransom. How might you find these computers on the internet? How do these nefarious people find them? They use a search engine like Shodan. Shodan, it's not necessarily built for nefarious purposes, but it certainly could be used that way. Let's you search for things based on their device type, their accessibility from the internet, all that stuff. It's a crazy website, and I'm not sure what its use is, but if you want to canvas the internet, man, this is the website that would let you do it. And if nothing else, even if you never have a use for it, it's good for all of us to know that this website exists for anyone that wants to use it. And if they were to shut Shodan down, it wouldn't matter because somebody else would create something like it. So it's a good reminder that we need to protect ourselves out there, and we need to be quite careful, and we need to pick good passwords, and we need to care about our firewalls and all of that stuff. Don't you think, John?
I think, and I can't find a specific link. Maybe I will for the lovingly handcrafted show notes. But I remember seeing an article a while ago, and it was like, here are all the HP printers that are visible on the internet. Go for it. As some of you may know, HP, especially their laser printers, some of them have a pretty sophisticated administrative interface, typically maybe not well password protected, or it's known. And if you put this on the internet and you don't realize it, or you open up a tunnel or whatever, you could have lots of fun. I remember back in my one of my corporate lives, I actually early on found this thing, a port scanner, and actually found, you know, I was like, oh, what stuff's on our, you know, up and coming IPv4 network here that is saying, hi, I'm here.
Sure.
It's like, oh, what's this thing called HP, blah, 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 and port 80. And I connected to it. And it was a web interface to an HP laser printer. And I'm like, wow.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, maybe number one, you should password that thing.
And, yeah, right.
Well, it was on an internal corporate network. But there are people that, I don't know, knowingly or unknowingly will share their printers or cameras or whatever on the internet. Hopefully the people that are sharing know they are.
Yeah, hopefully well, that's the thing, right? Yeah, you just got to be aware. It's that kind of world. So, it's interesting. You know, John, I'm seeing in the show notes, and sorry, not in the show notes, in the chat room here, that somebody's running a tunnel broker tunnel and is able to successfully complete a speed test using Comcast's speed test. Hmm. So maybe you can try it again. Maybe it was just one of those things that it, you know, hopped up in the wrong way. So, hey, new iSTAT menus came out this week, John.
Speaking,
you mentioned iSTAT menus. It does. It's what we need. It adds a lot of features, including the ability to manage RAM more. To work with the way Mavericks manages RAM and get a better result out of that, or more accurate result out of that. That's a necessary thing for those of us that are running Mavericks, and it's Yosemite capable. It does all the energy management and compressed memory and memory pressure, and it supports Yosemite's dark mode menu bar, which is cool.
IPv6.
It does show IPv6, but so did version 4. Yeah, it did.
And if you click on them, it copies them to the clipboard.
That's
paste them, because IPv6 addresses are big, man.
That's good.
You're not going to type that stuff in.
That's no. Crazy talk. No, that is crazy talk. I agree. It shows they've got a thing. No, it's showing in real time read and writes to the disk per app. So if you see that your disk is being thrashed upon, you can take a look and see what app it is that's reading and writing. Thrashed upon. Like my disk in our RAID array in the server was the other night.
Thrash upon you.
God, nothing is worse than getting home and wanting to go to sleep. And most of the time after gigs, I'm like wide awake and I can't sleep for hours. Friday night, I just wanted to go to sleep. And then I saw that email and I'm like, dang it, I'm up for a long time. And I was.
Should have just gone to sleep.
That would have been irresponsible.
People to do that for you. Oh, wait, you are.
I do. I pay people. But, you know, it's like I can't go to sleep and just forget about it. It's not how I roll. I don't know. Maybe I should roll that way, but I don't. I care too much. Mm-hmm. All right, John. So how are we going to do this here? You want to email us? You can email us at feedback@macgeekab.com.
I believe I heard feedback@macgeekab.com.
You did hear feedback@macgeekab.com. If you are a premium subscriber, you get premium at macgeekab.com as one of your premium benefits. And if you want to learn about how to support us directly, you certainly can do that. And we would very much appreciate it at macgeekab.com. We'll tell you all about it there. We would love to have you support us if you're able. If not, that's okay too. Please just keep listening. Keep sending in your questions, sending in your tips. We as a community make this work, so it's a beautiful thing. 206-666-GEEK is the phone number. John, Geek is
4-3-3-5.
Bet your bottom dollar it is. That's right. And tell them about Twitter, John, if you would. Where to find us?
Twitter's this new thing on the internet. If you haven't heard of it, check it out, man. Twitter.com. Sign up for an account. But some of us are on Twitter. Some have been on Twitter for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I am John F. Braun. He is Dave Hamilton. The podcast is Mac Geek App. The publication is Mac Observer. All on Twitter.
It is. It's true. I'd like to thank too, but, you know, collectively, on behalf of all of us, I'm thanking you, Michael Johnston. Yes, yes, you. Michael converts the show to AAC for us. He adds all the chapters. He adds all the links. He adds all the pictures. We know you folks love that stuff. And he does yeoman's work there every week for us to make that all happen in a timely fashion and get it out to you. So thank you, Michael. I encourage you to check out Michael's show, Michael's podcast, the iOS show. He does a great job over there. So check that out. He also runs GetAppler.com. We'll put a link to that in the show notes, too. Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, provides all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. And without them, you couldn't hear the show because we'd have no bandwidth. So thanks to the folks at Cashfly. It's a great team over there. Podcast marketplace includes the great folks at Barebones Software at barebones.com, the fantastic folks at Smile Software, at smilesoftware.com. As we mentioned, Gazelle, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E, Drobo, with coupon code MGG50 for a freaking great deal. We mentioned Lynda, check them out, coupon code, or Lynda MGG, lynda.com/MGG, iFixit, E3 Software, Direct Mail Mac, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. John, we've almost made it. But before we say that, there's one piece of advice I would like you to share with all of us.
Now, if that would be one piece of advice, then I think the advice you're thinking of is don't get caught.
We gotcha. Made up.